we've gotten. Navdanya, which means nine seeds, and my folder has, just by chance I'm carrying this folder, this design was actually taught to me by a tribal person in Tamil Nadu who explained to me, I thought I was educated in interconnectedness. I was out on seed-saving trip, and he had nine crops in his field. And I counted, because, you know, after Punjab, I would count crops. If I saw anything more than a monoculture, I would get very excited. And I saw nine crops. I said, wow, you're growing nine crops. And he says, yes, Navdanya. And then he explained to me, I mean, people think if you haven't been to Harvard University, you don't know. And here was this tribal in a remote forest giving me this lesson of how the nine planets in the cosmos, the nine crops in the field, and the balance in our body is one continuum of balance and harmony. And if he disrupts that balance, he's destroying the health of his family, he's destroying the earth, and even the cosmic balance.
You're listening to Vandana Shiva on interconnectedness. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get CDs of this program and her book, Oneness Versus the 1%, by calling us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977.
So when I wanted to save seeds, I started the seed-saving movement. It got the name Navdanya much later because of the inspiration of a tribal. But the inspiration for me initially was Gandhi. Because I said, if we had a cotton empire of cotton that took people from Africa, made them slaves, took the land of the indigenous people, pushed 60 million of my people to death due to famine, I said, what will be the violence of this empire over life? And I took lessons from him of how do you deal with an empire. He pulled out the spinning wheel and said, as long as we make our own cloth, we will be free. So I said, the spinning wheel of today, I thought very hard, what would it be for the empire of a life? And I focused on the seed. I didn't know anything about what to do with the seed. The design came to me from the spinning wheel. And from there, I started the work. We've created more than 140 community seed banks, including seed banks that have seeds that can tolerate salt and are an amazing response to hurricanes and cyclones as part of climate change. We've been able to build back agriculture along the coastal communities of the Bay of Bengal. Flood-tolerant rices. They're not being invented by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They've been co-evolved over millennia with co-creation between peasants and the earth. There has to be brilliance where one grass can contribute to 200,000 rice varieties. That's what India evolved. Just as much as one wild plant could give you the thousands of corn varieties in Mexico. And even better, the amazing systems of diversity in cultivation. Navdanya for us in Mexico and throughout the Americas, the three sisters. You never grow corn alone. You grow it always with squash and beans. And then they are a complete system, nourishing each other. That mutuality is what is sustainability. That mutuality is not just maintaining the health of the earth. It's also maintaining our health. Because we have externalized others so much, we forget that the biodiversity in the soil gives us more nutrition, gives us healthier plants, In industrial societies, foods have lost 60% of their nourishment. You're eating nutritionally empty food. And our work is showing that with biodiversity, with organic, with native seeds, which have far more nourishment, we can actually feed 2 times India's population through conservation. That's the other polarity, that if you conserve, you can't develop. But develop what? Development is a biological ecological term which basically talks of evolution from within. A seed becomes a plant, that's development. You were a fetus. You are developed. You're a developed fetus. That is development. But if you're bullied and trashed, that's not development. And fossil fuel yardstick has become the measure of development. Years ago, you know, I've thrown into dealing with the World Bank. Unbelievable. Those were the times where India had no plastic and no pesticides, and we were declared underdeveloped because we weren't using plastics and pesticides. And now India's drowning under plastic waste, and our peasants are dying with pesticide poisoning. We've done an assessment that every year, $1.3 trillion of damage to human beings and nature is taking place because of chemicals in farming. The book is called Wealth Per Acre. Measuring nutrition per acre, we created a health per acre to say what matters really is the nourishment of the food. It isn't the weight of a nutritionally empty toxic commodity. And part of what has surprised me so much in my long journey in agriculture is how we could be taken for a ride by total constructions. The construction of yield, which only measures what leaves the land, not what quality it is, nor what state does it leave the land in, whereas good agriculture is culture of the land and should be the production of nourishing food and regenerating the earth. As our work in Navdanya is showing, that farming has to be an act of gratitude to the earth. Thank you for giving us what you give us. And we give you back a part of what you have blessed us with. And interestingly, our work is showing that the more you give to the earth and in community, the more you have. Now, the extractive logic that came out of conquest is based on the need to take away everything from the last being and the last person. And giving then is treated as a loss. But all ecological teaching teaches us the more soil water, more water you give to this organic matter you give to the soil, the more water you have, the more nutrients you have, the more food you have. But that mechanistic idea that's blocking our ability to make the shift is, at the end of it, centered on an arrogance of a monopoly on creativity, a monopoly on intelligence. The assumption that's been created, whether it be the Descartes or the Bacons or the Boyles, they all work on the assumption that privileged, rich men are the only ones who have a mind. Women don't, nature definitely doesn't, and the other beings are just there to be exploited. The amazing generosity of the world is based on the recognition of the creativity throughout creation. Let there be a transition to nonviolent thinking, to nonviolent action, and to a humility that we need so desperately. And this becomes more and more important as the destruction of our health and the destruction of the planet's health makes us realize that creativity is the way life organizes herself. And when we mess up, there's one step ahead. So Roundup Ready crops gave us Roundup resistance weeds. That's evolution. Plants evolve. BT toxic crops gave us super pests that can't be controlled by BT toxin. There are analyses that are showing how I've done this for agriculture, but the more you destroy diversity, the easier it is for a pest or a disease to move through a system. And as we destroy the diversity of our forests and our ecosystems, the tiniest of microbes that evolves and mutates can start shifting to unpredictable places, and that mobility is something we didn't imagine, we didn't plan, and we don't recognize. It's that shift that we need, also because today the chronic disease, the communicable diseases are growing, but the chronic diseases which are affecting everyone with industrial foods, they are showing the link between the biodiversity outside, the biodiversity in the soil, and the biodiversity of our gut microbiome. We have a forest within us. Trillions of microbes in our gut. The gut is being called the second brain. We are only 10% human cells. The rest belong to other species. It's time to put away the arrogance that some humans are above other humans, and those other humans are superior to other species. That's anthropocentrism. Let's say bye-bye to racism, to sexism, to anthropocentrism, and celebrate the earth with the recognition that the earth is alive, women are actually brilliant, and all people have rights.
I think we have time for some questions.
Hi, I'm Brazilian. I'm sorry that we are now all unfortunately interconnected by having to deal with far-right lunatics such as Bolsonaro, Trump, and Modi. Recalling the article that you wrote about top investors of Facebook being the same as Monsanto, as well as Bill Gates' relations to the company, how do you see the role of big tech companies such as Amazon, Google, Facebook, Microsoft on the climate chaos? And how do you see their narratives, such as Jeff Bezos creating the Earth Fund, Google saying that their maps, AI, and big data will help us save the Amazon? And what do we do considering that much of our social movements are building and are using those technologies as well? Thank you.
These companies having that much wealth and the individuals having the kind of trillion-dollar wealth is all post-WTO. Because what's called globalization was deregulated commerce. That's what it was. And the first meeting of WTO was deregulating software trade. That's what shot up Microsoft. Big issues right now. I've just been in Calcutta where I launched a new initiative between Navdanya's organic farmers and hawkers, you know, street vendors, because 40% of the street vending was destroyed in the last 2 years by Amazon and Walmart in India. So we have to create tighter circular economies based on solidarity to counter these. I call them the extractive economies. That's what the colonizers did. That's what the fossil fuel economy did. It's an extractive system. But this system, too, is an extractive system, and it is a rent collection system. East India Company came, and the maid made money, said, this land is ours, and now you pay us the rent. And you starve to death because we'll take so such high rents, it's called lagan, that you won't be able to feed yourself. Exactly the issue on the seed patenting, which we have resisted, but behind the scene royalties are collected illegally. In the US, I did a calculation. American farmers are paying $10 billion annually in terms of technology fees and royalty payments on seed. 60% of the seed is in the hands of the four giants. It's interesting that suddenly tech has developed its own vocabulary. And it's not that we didn't have technologies before. It's just that we saw them as means, as tools, that we use according to our choice. For the first time in human history. Technology in the hands of the billionaires becomes the new civilizing mission for humanity. The illusions about the big technology firms is they create. They extract. They don't create anything. They, you know, software programmers create the platforms that they use. Even Bill Gates didn't really write his basic program. It was some professor, two math professors in Dartmouth College who did the basic program. They have posited themselves as inventors. When basically, we've done a new report, it's because Bill Gates announced a new project called AgOne. You know, all agriculture will be one agriculture controlled by him. Where does he set up the office of AgOne? In Missouri, where Monsanto's headquarters is. But we watch what's going on in India, and we pieced it together. So basically, he's financing a lot of data mining from farmers, which will then be packaged back as big data and sold back to the farmers. But this is exactly what happened in your 2016 elections. Facebook sold data to Cambridge Analytica. Cambridge Analytica analyzed the Facebook exchanges on the basis of four hates: hate of women, hate of blacks, hate of migrants, hate of Muslims. And the entire election was done on political ads based on those hates. So as the Newsweek said when it did this story, for the first time we have an artificial intelligent president. So when you think of why are the kind of leaders that we have getting created, it's very important to remember that in these 25 years of corporate deregulation of commerce, you basically have a lot of money in the hands of very few people. And they then are the ones investing in all the companies. The companies are not independent companies anymore. They're basically billionaire money managed by the investment funds like BlackRock and Vanguard, etc. They also know that everywhere people are on the streets. Just look at this year. Show me a country where there weren't protests. Chile, Beirut, Hong Kong, everywhere. So how do you deal with the rising demand for a change? We threw out the East India Company in 1857. The Crown took over. They established a policy called divide and rule. And then they started to divide Hindus and Muslims, because Hindus and Muslims had stood together to defend their land, their livelihoods, their freedom. This is what led to our partition. And that partition is still being played out. It's an incomplete project. So divide and rule becomes a necessity for the 1% to continue to hold on to power. And if you notice, everyone, I mean, this is something some of the graduate students should do. What are the economic policies being pushed while people are divided? Because that's really the agenda. And none of them make their own decisions. I watched the coup against Lula. How is it that they are such clones of each other? Because the powers that actually govern have put them in place because they know they'll do the job. We have to remember we are one humanity. We are part of one earth. And whatever we do, we will not let this basic recognition divide us, either from the earth or from each other. And together we are strong.
It's my reading and my experience that we've misunderstood Gandhi, that we look at him and think about political nonviolence, but he was also talking about economic nonviolence. I'm wondering what you can tell us about how we reintegrate those ideas into our systems today.
So, you know, this book, Oneness Versus the 1%, my last chapter is precisely on the three principles that Gandhi put into practice for not just political nonviolence, but economic system. Because his response really was from an empire that was based on violence. And he wanted to shape economies based on nonviolence because they were going to be the basis of freedom. And it's quite amazing to when you go to Sevagram, you see everything that you need in human society, he was experimenting with in terms of producing at the local level. So he had three key terms. The first was Swaraj, self-rule, but it also means self-organizing. The power to organize yourself individually or community, not in isolation, but in relationship. Swadeshi, off the place, local, and local living economies are an imperative. If we don't move there, we are going to see more and more people on the streets. We're going to see more and more people hungry. Look at the number of people who are hungry in this country. And then, of course, Satyagraha, which for Gandhi was the force of truth. And Gandhi, interestingly, practiced this first. In 1906, when this divide and rule and apartheid was being put in place, apartheid hadn't been named apartheid then. It was only named as a system in 1948. But in 1906, the British wanted to turn Indians in South Africa into second-class citizens. So they wrote an Indian Act. And so the people said, we would rather die than obey these laws. And Gandhi led that satyagraha. It's his first satyagraha. This refusal to cooperate with unjust law is what Gandhi called satyagraha, as a duty of truth. He was inspired by Thoreau, who refused to pay the poll tax here against the slave system. He inspired Martin Luther King. And the civil rights movement is very much inspired by Gandhi. But it is when King started to take up the economic justice and economic equality issues, that's when he was assassinated. Because the part is you can talk in very sweet ways about civil liberties, but you don't touch economic justice. And the economy is, for me, it's a double violence because the origin of the word, the meaning of the word economy comes from oikos, our home. The Aristotelian name is oikonomia, the art of living. And when you turn the art of living into the art of money making, which Aristotle called krematistics, then you have to practice violence against the earth and violence against others, destroy their livelihoods, destroy their freedoms, take away their resources. So the violence is multiple. And I look into the future. I say, why are we building detention centers everywhere in India, along the border of Mexico? Because I feel that if we don't activate our sense of interconnectedness with all life, with all people, if we don't start sowing the seeds of what I have called Earth democracy, we are going to see 99% people as disposable, especially with the tech working on artificial intelligence, to make sure all the mechanical work is made redundant, whether it be in radiography or law or whatever. Mechanical work will be substituted. And if that's the case, 99% people are disposable. So you can either share this beautiful planet with love and abundance and sustainability, or say, it's all mine, every bit of land, every seed, every mind, because what's being mined is our mind now. And if we don't defend the freedoms of all species and the freedoms of all human beings, we could see within 20, 30 years, a level of disposability built into the structures that humanity will not be able to respond to. So this is the time to make oneness and interconnectedness as one humanity on one planet the political project of our times.
You were just listening to Vandana Shiva on interconnectedness. She spoke at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Vandana Shiva is an internationally renowned voice for sustainable development and social justice. She's the author of many books, including Oneness Versus the 1%. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Angela Davis, Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, Tariq Ali, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. We also have a series of programs featuring Vandana Shiva. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Vandana Shiva on Interconnectedness, and for her book, Oneness Versus the 1%, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977, or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Sitar Maestro and my dear teacher, Debu Chowdhury, performing raga Shuddh Sarang.
The National Greening Program, run by Tree Canada, is dedicated to planting seedling trees across Canada in BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They prioritize planting on Indigenous and public lands and planting areas of natural and human-caused disturbance. The trees they plant help filter the air and water and sequester carbon, among other positive impacts. To learn more or get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For more than 10,000 years, the Chumash people have lived along the coast of what is now Central California.
The Chumash have been the stewards and the guardians of this area since time immemorial.
PJ Webb is a tribal advisor and board member of the Northern Chumash Tribal Council, a nonprofit. She says the region's coastal waters provide critical habitat for whales, otters, shellfish, and other species. And they're home to ancestral Chumash villages that were submerged by geological changes over millennia. So to protect this important area, her group has long advocated for about 7,000 square miles to be designated a National Marine Sanctuary. It would help protect the area from oil and gas exploration and drilling, as well as other development that could disturb the seabed floor. And it would provide a living laboratory for researchers to study the impact of climate change and ocean acidification on a wide range of species. The Northern Chumash Tribal Council nominated the sanctuary in 2015. Now, the federal government is in the final stages of the designation process.
The Chumash and the citizens and the communities of the Central Coast have been fighting for this for a long time. And now that we're almost there, it's joyous.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to CJSF 90.